Grüezi Amerika. News from the Sister Republic. A University of St. Gallen podcast by Claudia Brühwiler. Grüezi miteinander and welcome to another episode of Views from the Sister Republic. Today we are at the 55th St. Gallen Symposium, which is discussing a disrupted age. And one of the core topics there is geopolitics, though my guest here would probably more focus on geoeconomics. I'm joined today by Rüdiger Bachmann from the University of Michigan. Welcome to Grüezi Amerika.
Thanks for having me.
Professor Bachmann, you are a bit of a traitor, I have to say, because you once were a professor at the University of Notre Dame, and you had the audacity of switching to Michigan. And everyone from the region knows that's a no-go. What made you switch from being a Domer to a Michigander?
Well, as far as living is concerned, I've always lived in Ann Arbor, which is simply because of the fact that my wife is a professor at the University of Michigan.
Okay.
So the family has always lived in Ann Arbor. I was the one commuting. And there was really no push factor. I love Notre Dame. I love my colleagues there. It's a great place, a great intellectual environment. I've really enjoyed the Catholic liberalness, basically. And I mean this in a European sense there, namely the openness to discuss topics that maybe in some more secular, in particular state universities, some might feel more uncomfortable discussing. So I've really enjoyed my time there. But, you know, I'm also a family man. And at the end of the day, Michigan is a great place. It's an equally great place. It's different. It's a large public university as opposed to a very elite private university. But it's a great place. It's a great economics department, and I'm simply happy.
So you didn't switch football teams. You just switched universities.
Since I don't have a football team to begin with, this is something I always think that the passion for sports must be, you know, it must be born when you're young, and you basically stick with those passions. And that means, given that I grew up in Germany, I just don't have a passion for American football.
Oh, well, you're excused on that account, but I had to poke you a bit on this.
That's
since we're
totally
both
fair.
Affiliated with Nanovic Institute
and
at Notre Dame.
Still, but so that's my last line towards Notre Dame, and I'm very happy about that. But there's nearly nothing spicy to be had. It's a very mundane family thing.
Well, you're traveling between academic and worlds in general. You started out your academic journey in Germany, in the beautiful city of Mainz, that you exchanged then for the beautiful campus of Yale University in the acquired taste of New Haven, New Jersey. And then you went on off to the Midwest with stops, though, back home again with RWTH Aachen, for instance. And now you have been in the US for more than two decades.
Yep.
As an economist, what do you think is one of the biggest misconceptions when we're looking at American economics, at the American economy? What do Europeans usually get wrong when they look at the state of play in the US?
It's difficult to pick one thing, but
what's a major thing you would say?
I mean, let me pick two things. The prejudice, there are two prejudices there, which is the state of education. I think a lot of Europeans think that education in the United States is terrible and bad, and that's just not the case. It's highly unequal. Mm-hmm. So there are very terrible and bad places, that's for sure. But also the best education places in the United States are in the United States. If you look at PISA statistics, if I remember this correctly, if you sort of split it up by race in particular, unfortunately, there is a race component, so there's a lot to be criticized. But the PISA results of white America, of Asian Americans, I think are actually higher than those in Shanghai, which is typically the top. So there's a lot not to like about the inequality of the American education system, but it's not generally bad. That's number one. And similar, the same thing is with the social safety net and the healthcare system. Again, it's extremely unequal. The social welfare system is clearly not as cushy as it is in in Germany, probably also not in Switzerland. But, you know, it's also the case that Europeans just think, you know, you lose your job and then you live on the street or something like that. That's also not the case. The United States, they have welfare programs, they have social security. And we also have healthcare, and we have an extremely innovative healthcare system. It's way too expensive. So again, there's a lot to critique, but sort of this very wholesale a judgment from people that, you know, that don't know, really know what they're talking about, and that may know America from, and maybe the third, and now that I'm thinking about that, the third thing, a lot of the viewpoints in Europe come from visiting New York and the East Coast, maybe the West Coast, but then they don't know what's going on in the Midwest, in what in America we call somewhat, you know, pejoratively the flyover states. Maybe more positively, the heartland. Anyway, so America is a lot more, you know, variegated, a lot more diverse than most Europeans can imagine.
And although the reasons why Donald Trump triumphed in 2024 are also quite diverse, many pinpointed the economy. As an economist living in America, having taught economics in America for decades, when you look back at the state of the economy in 2024, did you also see the economy as a reason for the Democrats to lose the election? Or did you think that certain issues were overstated and that the Democrats just sold their economy badly?
I think there were two issues. I think one of them was the economy. It was the living cost crisis, the affordability crisis, which has many components. And that was real in a sense. As an economist, so first of all, as an economist, of course, I'm not just an economist, I'm also a political person. It still wouldn't have been a reason, it shouldn't have been a reason after, for example, January 6th to vote for Trump again. And in a way, there are more important things, or they're equally important things as the economy. Maybe not more, but equally important, which is democracy and the rule of law. And also, you know, the fact that you have to have some trust that it's actually getting better. And those of us who pointed out that it won't get better with Trump, even the economy on sort of this own very narrow field where some thought he might have a superior abilities or policy platform to the Democrats, people who kind of in the know knew always that this wasn't the case. But there was a real economic crisis, absolutely. The affordability crisis, which we economists understand why that came about. It was a mixture of supply-side issues from COVID, from the energy, various energy shocks we have seen, and also quite a bit of demand stimulation, in particular post-COVID. And there, indeed, Biden made the political, he may not have won the 2020 election otherwise, but he promised a very large stimulus package during the campaign. And during the campaign, it might have still be, it certainly was politically astute to do it. It might even have been economically justified. The problem when the package then finally came, the damage, the economic damage, in other words, the economy was already self-healing. And so, in other words, it hit basically the economy in a state where it certainly didn't need this kind of stimulus anymore. There was probably room for a more targeted poverty fighting stimulus program, but not this wholesale fiscal stimulus that Biden had promised that he couldn't go back after he was in office. Otherwise, he would have lied, obviously. That would have been politically bad. But economically, it wasn't a good thing either. And that also contributed quite a bit to the cost of living crisis. And then the second issue, it was indeed immigration. Immigration was a real issue. The Americans correctly, and of course, did the right overdo this? Did Fox News 24/7? Exaggerate the state at the border? Probably, or almost surely, yes. But that doesn't mean that there wasn't an underlying problem. There was a certain sense of being out of control, being lawless. I will defend Joe Biden, though. He had a quality that I actually find endearing, but in this day and age was perhaps a bit politically outmoded and even naive. He basically wanted Congress, he basically said, I don't have the executive authority to close the border. I want Congress to give me a law. So he was, in that sense, a legislative supremacist, which I have absolute sympathy for. I mean, and you can explain this with his biography. He was, what, a senator for, I don't know, four decades or something, more than four decades.
Practically all his political life.
All his political life. So I have a lot of sympathy for that. And Congress, it took a while, but Congress actually put up a bipartisan border package, immigration package, that even the most hardline conservative senators were on board. To name one man who negotiated it for on the GOP side was the Oklahoma Senator Lankford, who is an absolute arch conservative that is not a bleeding heart liberal by any stretch of the administration imagination. And so he negotiated that, and it was a deal. It came too late, but the deal was killed by Trump for purely campaign reasons. And at that point, then Biden closed the border per executive order. But then he looked like he was a liar, right? He wanted to be a legislative supremacist. He wanted to defer to the legislative. But in this time and age of imperial presidencies that Trump sort of has established, he looked like in the eyes of the people, MAGA certainly, but also the independents, the swing voters, he looked like a weakling, basically. And that combination of the cost of living crisis and the strategic mistakes, not the substantive mistake, but the strategic mistakes at the border, basically cost them the election in the middle, because Trump won this election not through MAGA people, but in the middle.
Now, we fast forward to today, and we're drawing up the health chart of the American economy. Now, looking from outside in, as Europeans, particularly as Swiss people, we are particularly concerned by the erratic tariff policies that we have been exposed to.
Yes, you should. It's insane, but yeah, you should be concerned. And I, as an American, I'm concerned about it, yeah.
The other factor is now the blockage again of the Strait of Hormuz and the ripple effect that has on our economies. But from an insider's perspective, from an American perspective, are these the main economic concerns that you see, or is the inner American perspective a different one?
No, I would agree. I would basically perhaps distinguish a bit more between the short and the long run. I think in the short run, you are absolutely pointing to the right issues, massive policy uncertainty, rising interest rates, or rising risk premium for American government bonds, the slow sort of sell America out of the dollar. So those are all mistakes. They're completely self-inflicted. The high gas prices, which and this is, I think this is important to explain, still, even though America is a net producer, net exporter of oil, still hurts most of the American economy, because most Americans, while the economy as a whole is sort of a net producer, net exporter, and benefits from it, most Americans are, of course, net consumers of oil, and so they are hurt. So this is this makes some people rich, very rich, but doesn't benefit the economy at all. So that's pretty clear. Another issue that's in the context of the Iran war that's not talked about enough, I think, is fertilizer, which is extremely important. It's probably catastrophic for areas like sub-Saharan Africa, but it's also bad for the U.S. farmers who are going into bankruptcy. Who are really having trouble, fertilizing there. And we will see this in rising food prices. I mean, then I don't think Americans will go hungry in the fall, but we will see this in rising food prices massively. And this will exacerbate the cost of living crisis, which already, hasn't really been solved and has been exacerbated through the rising gas prices, later rising food prices. And that whole thing then will sort of, because gas prices means deliveries will be more expensive, and then it will kind of go through the entire range of products. So we'll probably see the Fed having to raise interest rates, which will not help with the housing crisis that we have in the United States. So all these issues that, you know, Biden was voted out of, or the Democrats lost the White House for, are just sort of reappearing again. And in fact, have been exacerbated by this administration, where the promise was to at least alleviate them. The long run, if I may make this distinction there, I think I would push a few other ideas. In the sense, maybe let me start with three. The first one is immigration policy, where I think this will indeed hurt American higher education if it's not reversed soon. And it's not going to be clear that a Democratic president will reverse that so easily, because it's true that even Americans on the left feel like, oh, there are these foreign students going to Harvard. Couldn't that be an American kid? And so, but, you know, the cost of this is sort of a hidden cost. You know, not having these smart pride kids from all over the world, not having these smart doctoral students from all over the world, just makes American higher education, research, idea generation, idea dissemination less effective and less efficient. And so, and in the long run, this will hurt America. So immigration is has many other problems. It's and certainly the deportation policies are just cruel, but sort of from an economic point of view, that I think is a long run, definitely a long run issue. And then and that combined with our disastrous science policy that we have, there was certainly, if I have to find some good about the Trump administration, is indeed that it hopefully, I think it would have come anyway, but I think it accelerated the end of peak war. It basically sort of brought us to peak woke quicker, and basically in higher education, and accelerated its demise. Universities just had to react. I wish this could have been done differently. It should have been done differently. But for better or for worse, that's what the Trump administration achieved. Nevertheless, their science policy is completely overboard. It's disastrous. It's bad for the hard sciences, not for the gender studies that they presumably wanted to hit. It's bad for the hard sciences. It's bad for the medical sciences, biomedical sciences. And the idea is Silicon Valley would like to privatize a lot of this research and get it out of the universities, because they want to capitalize on it and not have it, so for them, knowledge is not what it should be, namely a public good. So I think that's going to hurt us, because if this is going to be a permanent move, that sort of knowledge creation is sort of pushed ever more in sort of the private sector, and therefore sort of is less likely to contribute to inclusive growth. I think this will will sort of cement oligarchic and oligopolistic structures. That's something that's worrying to me. And the third part now with AI, the AI revolution, a couple of things. We still don't know. The fact that the American economy still grows, as opposed to, say, you know, my other home country, Germany, is essentially, it's not a very inclusive growth, right? It's the labor market doesn't look good. It's a growth that's basically mainly AI related. We are probably there might be a little bit of a technological bubble. Certainly, there seems to be what economists call a tournament structure here. Namely, there's a prize that everyone wants to have, namely Gen AI. And I'm not saying that's actually the truth, but that seems to be the narrative, and that's the narrative that's driving the behavior currently. And so a lot of investment is going into it. But if it's really a tournament, only one can get the first prize, and all other investments are basically have been bubbly and will have to be, you know, mal investments ex post. And so there might be a lot of resources wasted ex post, and that could lead itself to an economic slump, or, you know, recessionary effects. And more generally for the state of democracy, I am worried about AI, because if the vision of Silicon Valley is actually true, And that's a big if.
You're referencing the CARP manifesto, for instance.
Gen AI and its capabilities, basically. Mm. But if that is true, I think what this really means is that A, you don't need workers. And so what disciplined workers in the 19th century, what disciplined oligarchs and capitalists in the 19th century was simply the fact that at some point it became too costly to, you know, workers, occupied plans, workplaces. Then the capitalists had to call the police, the government helped, the state helped them beat up the workers. At some point it just became too costly and they said, why don't we sit down together and negotiate about working conditions and wages? And that's, you know, how we, why we established our modern, you know, capital labor relationships, that you know, are not just peaceful for most of the times, but also somewhat efficient. There's a somewhat efficient bargaining going on. And the question is, what, how will that look like when workers are no longer needed? Secondly, if it's really true, these guys won't need consumers either anymore, because that was the second, you know, pacifying and disciplining force, was that at some point these guys figured out that, you know, if I can, if these other people have a lot of money, they can buy my stuff and I can do mass produce and I can make more profits. And so while from a purely management perspective, from a purely micro perspective, as a company owner, that may not have been so important to you. But once you understood that as an entrepreneur, your political economy views shift. You will be more open to redistribution. To anyway, so all of this, all of this might be gone, because if it's true what they think they can do with AI, you know, they will have robots. They, whatever consumption these oligarchs want to have, will, they don't have to go through the sort of the detour of generating profits through mass consumption anymore, because these robots are just going to produce whatever consumption these guys want to have without workers. So they don't need consumers either anymore. So now they don't need us as consumers. They don't need us as workers. And then if we rise up and complain and want a part of the peace, they also have the drones. And that's what I'm worried about. And I don't know that. So what I'm hoping is that we see a 2028 campaign, a smart democratic politician actually formulate an AI policy for a 21st democracy. And that is really a vision that I haven't seen. I haven't seen this in any major campaign in the world, but I think it's something that's absolutely direly needed.
That's very long-term, though. I mean, for politics to dream up.
Yeah, I think this is around the corner.
Yeah.
This is around the corner and we need to have answers. And this, the next campaign in 2028 may be the last campaign to actually formulate this.
I don't disagree with the fact that it's absolutely needed, but looking at the short-termism of American politics, I think another issue will be more pertinent right now for the political debate. And I'd like to come back to what you earlier outlined as problems in the short term for the American economy before we move to inclusive growth.
Yeah, can I say one more
thing?
Sure. I actually think a smart politician can make it short-term enough to be a campaign topic. Because right now, there is an arising strange coalition in America where you see rural people, where these data centers being built, really being pissed at the oligarchs. So there's also a sort of a fracturing. There are many fractions of the Trump coalition, but this is one specific one, right? Because it's their houses that, you know, where maybe water, the provision of basic needs like water was already precarious. And now it's gone, basically. There's no water pressure. So it's something physical. If you wake up in the morning and can't shower properly because the water pressure is down, people, and again, mega people in rural areas are pissed at the oligarchs. And that is something that a smart politician, not for the midterms, but for the next presidential campaign, if they make it a topic, could actually be almost Obama-like, who also had, let's not forget, Obama won at least once Indiana, won Ohio, I believe.
Absolutely,
twice.
Yeah.
He won Florida at least once, maybe twice. I would have to go back. So see, Obama managed to have this coalition including the rural areas of America. And a smart democratic politician may do something Obama-like. I'm not saying exactly the same thing. Something Obama-like, where sort of it goes beyond slightly populist, but it goes beyond sort of these traditional divides that we are currently seeing.
I absolutely agree with you on that point, also on the necessity, and that in certain parts it's already more urgent. I have doubts whether we will see that smartness, but I think that's for...
Let's never give up hope. There are some smart people in the Democratic Party, even if we don't see them just
that's
yet.
That's true. And we've been reminded, I think it was yesterday, by Ivan Krastev at the 55th St. Gallen Symposium, to never lose hope, particularly not in the self-correcting force of democracy.
Because and especially for America, because it's such a diverse place.
Absolutely.
There's somewhere some smart politician that, let's not forget, 2 years or at this stage of the Obama campaign, before the Obama presidency, very few people knew about Barack Obama.
That's true, yeah.
So,
but we already had those in the know, or those who were following politics closely, had seen his appearances, had taken note of his race speech, for instance. And so, and what worries me is that those in the know can't point me to a new Obama, but I am with you. There's always hope for smartness.
I have a few ideas, so we will see.
But I'd like to come back to the more short-term issues that will definitely come up again in the midterm elections.
Absolutely, yeah.
And that is the affordability crisis. You've mentioned this several times, but I'd like you to outline what that actually means, because I have a feeling that many Europeans, they hear affordability crisis, etc., but they have often not a true understanding of what Americans are dealing with. So could you maybe outline what the situation actually is, what is economically driving it, and what a smart answer to it would be? So three questions into one. You should usually not do that, but I think you can do it.
I'll try. So perhaps it's important to contrast this a little bit against the headline numbers, because, you know, if you just look at GDP growth, it's not great for America. It's, I think the last number we have was Q1 of this year. It's 2% annualized. That's not great for America. That's much better than Germany, certainly.
Yeah.
The Germans would, you know, celebrate if they had 2% growth, but for the end, again, moreover, it's concentrated in a very specific sector, namely AI investment, essentially. So the labor market already points a much bleaker picture, in particular the kind of labor market that Trump promised that he would help them, namely the manufacturing labor market. The manufacturing sector has lost employment ever since for all months in the Trump administration. I'm not even saying Trump is necessarily, partly he's to blame because of the stupid, say, tariff policies that actually hurt the manufacturing sector. Also because of Trump's stupid energy policies, right? They shut down windmills in the midst of being built, and people, electricians lost their job because of that and that kind of stuff. But partly, you know, it's kind of unavoidable. There's a lot of sort of structural change that no president could do anything about to begin with. So I'm not laying blame wholly on Trump. Inflation has ticked up again, and nominal wages not keeping up, necessarily keeping up. Mortgage interest rates have come down a bit, but not where they were, for example, in the, just a couple of years ago. And people remember that, and they kind of see people, you know, being able to, 10 years ago, being able to afford a house, have a 30-year mortgage with interest rates, I don't know, 2.5%. But now they pay, I don't know, would have to look it up, but it's certainly higher than 2.5%. We are down from 7-8%, which was the peak. But the problem is we may very well go back, given that the Federal Reserve will probably have to do something against those inflationary pressures. So we see it. Also in these, and economists have been measuring these psychological numbers as well, namely the sentiment. We see it in the Michigan consumer sentiment, which is a long time series of, consumer sentiment, the mood of the American consumer. And you clearly see this is at the lowest, this is at a historically low level. This is basically at the level of the trough of the COVID recession, which is the worst recession since Michigan, my home university, has the survey in the field. You see it with all kinds of uncertainty indices, policy uncertainty indices that are just not coming down. They peak sometimes when Trump does something crazy, then they come down a bit, but never sort of going back to pre-Trump. And so, and all of, and sort of all long-term economic decisions are obviously, are more problematic in a face of uncertainty because you just don't know. And so you have short-termism, you don't invest. And that's sort of hurting America all around.
What would be a smart response to that if you had to advise?
Stop doing the stupid stuff. That's the first part, right? Just, you know, stop doing these crazy tariff policies. Stop doing, and you know, crazy wars that make everything more expensive. Formulate an inclusive and an AI policy that's compatible with democracy, with liberal republican democracy that's inclusive. Trump promised about to solve the housing crisis.
Yeah, I wanted to come to that.
To build more. The Democrats have not been good about that, but you know, embrace something like the abundance program that some on the American center left have been pushing, which is essentially a leftist supply side economics, where basically build, you know, get rid of zoning restrictions, et cetera, et cetera. You know, the immigration policy doesn't help with housing. If you throw out Latinos, which are disproportionately engaged in particular in states where there is a housing crisis like California, that are disproportionately, you know, working in the construction sector. If you throw them out, you know, no surprise that housing costs. So even if you do something about zoning, you know, zoning laws, you know, if housing costs, the actual building costs rise because you don't have enough workers because you kicked them out in the first place. You know, all this is sort of this stupid stuff that are just, I think there is a fundamental health to the American economy. It could be vibrant. It was vibrant. And it needed to be more inclusive. That's for sure. But that would have been the right policies, not doing all this crazy stuff.
I mean, some of the intention of the post-liberal faction and the Trump administration was to make the economy more inclusive. They were particularly looking at the region that you call home now, namely the Midwest. And as you said earlier, their intention is to make manufacturing strong again. But it's obviously backfiring.
This has always been fake. Trump has no interest in the American worker whatsoever. I mean, Trump is a kleptocrat and he's an entertainer, reality TV star. He couldn't care less about the fate. This was, you know, so my former colleague Patrick Deneen. I believe him sincerely that this is something that he cares about American rural communities. But they just picked the wrong ally. And why would you think that a billionaire like Trump, a real estate mogul, a kleptocrat, the head of essentially a mafia-like family, wouldn't use this presidency for self-enrichment and self-aggrandizement? I mean, the biggest domestic policy issues right now in the United States is building a ballroom and building a triumphal arch. That's what we're talking about, not about housing policies, right? And so why would you think that? Why would you think that Elon Musk, billionaires like Elon Musk or Peter Thiel would want to do anything to advance the American worker or the people in the Midwest? They have no interest in that. And, you know, now you can say J.D. Vance, he grew up himself, but, you know, he's a phony. I mean, he's a complete phony. He basically, you know, he got hooked into the Silicon Valley mindset by working, you know, in venture capital. I mean, sort of the moment he came back, so he started at Yale. You know, he apparently liked to hang out with the elites, even though he, you know, says he hates the elites. But no, he's as elite as you can be. He has a Yale degree. He afterwards went into finance. And so why would you think that this is, and by the way, if you read the book more closely, you will actually notice the real disdain he has for most people living in the Midwest, living in Appalachia,
You're referring to Hillbilly Elegy.
Hillbilly Elegy, yes. So if you read that closely, you will notice this. So again, the post-liberals just hooked. If they really are sincere, and for some, I'm willing to give them the benefit of the doubt that they were sincere, I think they just hooked up with the wrong allies.
But what would actually benefit rural communities? Because you said, well, generally cut out the stupid policies that have been enacted by the Trump administration, but rural communities were ailing before Trump and were dissatisfied with Democrats as well. So what would be a good strategy for the rural development and bringing the Rust Belt back to bloom?
I don't know that there are. That's the problem. I don't think anyone has the has a silver bullet there.
Yeah.
I mean, it's very possible that some of these communities, because they are beyond saving, some of them are so dysfunctional that probably they're better off actually if they're dying. And this sounds disdainful, but it really is. On the other hand, this is not a rural community, but this is certainly a city that was dying, namely Detroit. Has somehow managed to come back a little bit? And this is a city that is sort of close to me, right? So they basically used the absolute trough that they had to go through, but somehow that attracted young innovative people that went into urban farming. So Detroit downtown is now not vibrant yet, but it's certainly better than it was 10 years ago, and you can see sort of a new urban awakening in Detroit. And I'm not an expert in regional economics, but I do think if you sort of talk to people that specialize, the idea sort of, but this is something that's so antithetical to, the traditional Republican Party, that the idea that we have no place-based policy whatsoever in the United States, everything is, again, we have social safety nets. We also, in the United States, are relatively unideological about, sort of Keynesian macroeconomic stabilization policies. There, even the Republicans are much sort of more pragmatic than, say, German auto-liberals or something like that, right? So that the United States is relatively unideological. But there's other ideologies here, namely the idea that we don't use place-based policy at all, or that the non-recognition of sort of regional doom spirals where, there's some shock. Then people who are able, willing, and have the means to move out. That erodes your tax base. That, because a lot of it is locally, like schools is locally financed, a lot of infrastructure locally financed, that sort of erodes your public infrastructure relatively quickly, and more people move out, and you get basically these doom loops, right? And so that's something that, if you have these doom loops, that's where, you want to have larger entities, either if it's sort of a smaller region within a state, the state, or, maybe the federal government come in and sort of insure regions against these shocks. And we have some of it through the unemployment insurance mechanism in the United States, but I don't think we have sort of an optimal regional policy. I'll leave it at that abstract level because, again, I'm not an expert in that. I don't have the literature in front of me that could tell us what works and what doesn't, but I'm sure my colleagues in regional economics could advise anyone in the U.S. government who would be interested if they only listened.
We are only months away from the midterm elections. As an economist, what will you particularly focus on to see and understand the dynamics that the election will unfold in? What are the parameters that we should focus on to understand what might happen?
I think the first important thing is to understand that the midterm elections, even though they elect a federal or national body, are really 435, which is the number of House seats, plus 30-something Senate seats, and elections, okay? Which are somewhat independent of each other. Yes, there's, like we would say in Germany or probably in Switzerland too, something like a Bundestrend or a national effect for sure. And obviously this is going to matter a lot now. This is going to be an anti-Trump election. I think that much can already be predicted. But at the end of the day, it's still sort of, it's really a lot of election, parallel elections with somewhat different topics, and in particular, somewhat different candidates. And that means that, you know, sort of a lot of people that talk to me always ask, where is the opposition leader? Where is the Democrat that will why are the Democrats so weak? And I said, no, the last thing that the Democratic Party right now needs is a national leader. That Gavin Newsom does this a little bit on Twitter is nice and cute and, you know, super.
Cute is a mean word in that context.
I think it's nice. Okay, let me say nice and great. Because it just provides for endless comedic value. So I really appreciate those memes. They're just great. Is it really strictly necessary politically? I doubt it. Will it help Newsom for his own candidacy? Remains to be seen. In any event, the last thing you want is an opposition leader right now, because the Republican Party has become so extremist that the Democrats, if they want to win, they need to spend such a big tent, you know, from far left to center, perhaps center slight right, okay, that you know, picking a national candidate now would have to mean that you already take sides, that you basically say this is going to be our national profile. It's going to be difficult enough to do that after the midterms, but certainly you don't want to do this during the midterms because, as I said, there are many, many different races, and you don't want, and you want the Democrats to make this about local candidates, meaning the candidate for Senate in Texas, James Talarico, needs to be a very different candidate than the candidate in Manhattan, lower Manhattan district. So that much needs to be clear, and sort of a national opposition leader that already determines where the Democratic sort of party is going to be, will only be damaging in this process. So I think that's important for Europeans to understand. So it's really important that you understand the vast heterogeneity of these elections, and if you are really interested in sort of the outcome, especially in the Senate, I don't think you need to be too worried about the outcome in the House. I think at this point, unless there's some, I mean, there's still the possibility, although I don't put a lot of probability into it, it's still the possibility that we won't really have an election. I mean, that Trump basically just puts up, you know, some troops, some paramilitary troops. ICE agents on the streets, and we won't really have free and fair elections. Again, I don't put a lot. I don't think this will fly in America. I don't think it will get away with that. But we'll see. I can't exclude it at this point either. But assuming we have, fair and free elections, and barring something that, sure, I can't foresee, but, you know, even assassination attempts on the president don't seem, no one cares about this this ballroom thing. Truly, I mean, it's also true that the pictures weren't quite there as in Butler. But, you know, the way Butler probably helped Trump win the election.
You mean the first assassination?
The first assassination attempt with the ear thing certainly contributed to his election. I mean, there's no such effect whatsoever from the recent ballroom assassination attempt. Again, the pictures were a bit different, but it's hard for me to imagine what still could happen in the world. But again, I've been wrong repeatedly about such things, so that could shape this. So the bottom line is, I don't think you need to worry about the House. I'm gonna just put that in the blue column, in the Democratic column. The more interesting races is indeed the Senate, and that is somewhat decisive because, yes, the House is good in the sense of making this the last 2 years of a Trump administration a lame duck administration, but the Senate really, you know, the Senate is important for judiciary appointments and, you know, and all appointments, frankly, and if the Republicans still can do that freely, they can still shape for a rather long term American society. So winning the Senate, which is an uphill battle, given which states currently which state senators are up for election, is absolutely crucial for the Democrats, I think. And there, if people are interested, then they really need to drill down and basically find, you know, the local reporters on Twitter from Ohio, which is one of those states, from Maine, from Michigan, actually, where the Democrats hold the seat, but there's some potentially stupid internal politics where they might push a radically left candidate against a Republican candidate that's actually somewhat centrist, not necessarily MAGA, but somewhat centrist. So that's very dangerous. Georgia, they need to look at Georgia. They need to look at Alaska. So there's a bunch of maybe Texas. Texas is going to be very interesting because James Talarico, for me, is one of the great political talents right now that in Europe people might not know. So will he win? Will he achieve? Will he achieve this this miracle of beating a Texas GOP senator?
Will he be what Beto O'Rourke didn't become?
Could he do what Beto O'Rourke couldn't do? So those are the races that that Europeans, if they want to follow this closely, and you know, those are the races. But you need to drill down. You basically need to really follow the local reporters. You know, Georgia has reporters that you need to follow Georgia politics, Ohio politics. It's really that variegated. I'm not saying you recommend that, but if you're such a nerd, if you're really interested, you need to do that. There's no other way.
Rüdiger Bachmann, we've come in this conversation a long way. We've taken the eagle-eye perspective on the economy overall, and now we're down in Ohio in the trenches of the Senate.
Local politics. All politics is local, particularly in the United States.
It still is, and thankfully so, I would say. And now, to conclude, I normally ask our guests for reading recommendations, but you've teased that you have two or three names in your head that you think could make the presidential ticket for the Democrats and actually make a difference in 2028. And so to close out, I invite you to share with our listeners, who are the two or three Democrats to watch out for?
Andy Beshear, the current governor of Kentucky, who, you know, is the governor in a ruby red state. He has ambitions. He's charismatic. I encourage everyone to follow James Talarico, although I do think it's a bit too early for him. He's an absolutely great political talent. He needs to make this miracle happen in Texas, become a senator then. But again, it might be too early to run again. Maybe he should. But that's still someone that is just refreshing, that brings a different perspective on U.S. politics. And then who else?
Is there a woman in the mix?
I mean, there's certainly Gretchen Whitmer, my current governor, who won't be able to run anymore, who will be a contender, I assume. I also find, and again, he denies that he will running, but basically they all deny running. An extremely effective communicator is someone like John Ossoff, this is the current senator from Georgia, who is up right now, who again needs to win. We will see about that, but it's looking good. But the way he communicates, the way he Gavin Newsom sort of takes off the farcicalness of the Trump administration and sort of reflects it right back at him and sort of has this comedic elements. John Ossoff has this talent to really be serious, but without being nerdy about it. So again, somewhat Obama-like quality, right? So he really can, you know, he will say, you know, he has a way of creating ads and online content where he sort of contrasts the fact that, you know, a lot of people have lost their health insurance or saw premium rising now with the ballroom as the main topic. He has a way of putting that together that's, I think it seems extremely appealing, especially for social media, people who've grown up in a social media kind of environment. So we'll see. Those are politicians that people might want to look at.
But now you've left out, quote unquote, our mayor, former mayor of South Bend, Pete Buttigieg. Does he not make your ticket?
I don't know. I'm a big fan of Pete Buttigieg. I like his centrist politics. Not sure whether he's interested in running, but he has trouble with African Americans. He has, for some reason, he has not, and obviously that's a constituency you really need as a Democrat to win. He needs to figure out a way to appeal to African Americans if he can overcome that, I think he might be a contender too. Yeah.
And then we might drink to Notre Dame again. Thank you so much.
Although he has no affiliation with Notre Dame, other than his father being having been a professor.
That's a major affiliation.
Fair enough. And but he never went to Notre Dame, even though he's from South Bend. He didn't go to Notre Dame. He went to Harvard. So he himself doesn't actually have a lot of connections to Notre Dame.
But he
has a lot of fans at Notre Dame, yes.
Absolutely. And he is the father of the city. Well, was one.
Yes.
Was the father of the city. Yeah. So that's fair enough for us, right? So thank you so much, Rüdiger Bachmann, for joining us here in St. Gallen at the occasion of the 55th St. Gallen Symposium here at our university. Thank you for joining me here at Square. And thank you to all our listeners. Wish you a great one and auf Wiedersehen.
Grüezi Amerika. News from the Sister Republic. A University of St. Gallen podcast by Claudia Brühwiler.